The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
So as I said, my name's Anita. I teach for the 12-step recovery mindfulness group. And so my entrance into meditation was suffering, of course. So I first went to Common Ground when it was down the street about 14 years ago, where Mark and Wynn currently reside. And I took a mindfulness course with Mark, just a beginning mindfulness. I wanted to reduce my anxiety, do something about my depression. Wasn't really thinking about substance use at the time. That came a couple years later after meditating for a while and trying to practice mindfulness. I'm like, oh, well, I can't use these intoxicants. So those went out the window. And then after I lost my substances of choice, I was even more depressed. So those mental formations that I needed to calm, I didn't know how to do that. They're very habitual. Thoughts are very quick and very repetitive. So you can imagine, like, how many times have you had that same negative thought? A million or in your lifetime? I mean, who knows how many times a repetitive negative thought could manifest over and over. So it can be, we need good tools and good solid strategies for how to take care of our mental formations. And the Buddhist meditation practice is simple, but it's not easy. Those first eight instructions, they're simple, but they're not always easy. There's times when I want to sit down and practice what I preach, but my mind is way not going to do it. what I would like to share a little bit today is what helped me shift somewhat, quite a bit actually. 4 years ago, a little over 4 years ago, I took some time and went to two monasteries in New Zealand in the Thai Theravada forest tradition. I was fortunate enough to be there when some of our senior Western monks in the tradition were there at the same time. Ajahn Tiridhama was leaving his post as the abbot at Wellington at the monastery there. And so his friends came to visit and support him. So I met Ajahn Suchito and Ajahn Viridhamo, these guys are all in their 60s. They actually met as teenage, you know, young adults traveling in India and doing the whole guru smoking this and that thing. It was fun to hear him talking about those days where they were riding around their bikes in India and, you know, being high on this or that, but and meeting gurus. And so that was the 70s, I think, maybe late 60s. But they fell into this tradition. They've been monks for about 40 years. Ajahn Vajira was also taking a respite at the monastery at Vimuti when I was there. So these are, I just got some really excellent teaching when I was there. It was wonderful. So I was there for 4 months. And what these teachers had in common, what I found they had in common, was that they all started out with doing something. Try to do something when you first sit down to brighten your heart. So I complained to Ajahn Vajira. I had been at the monastery for 6 weeks, and I said, been here for 6 weeks, and my mind is still chatting away endlessly, and my heart hurts. Oh, he said, So then he said, you know, there's monks that have been practicing for 3 years. Their mind is still rattling away. You know, it doesn't just stop, even in the most best of conditions. So we have to learn how to accept it and be kind towards it and be friendly towards ourselves. As far as my heart went, he said, does it hurt here? Pointed to the spot on my elbow. I was like, no. He said, well, put your mind there then. I was like, okay. And it was really useful. It was really useful. My heart hurt a lot, and I wasn't doing any good hanging around there. It hurt. And so I kind of got more aware of my whole body and this, you know, well, let's just put the mind elsewhere. Quit focusing on that. So that was really useful from Ajahn Vajiro. He also, he would always start a sit. Something, okay. He would always start a sit by saying, remember that even neutral sensations can be pleasant. And he would repeat it. Remember that even neutral sensations can be pleasant. And so I've been studying, you know, the field of working in the field of addictions and recovery, but a big issue for people is boredom. And so if you take this information of even neutral sensations can be pleasant, you can be pleasantly bored. I mean, there's nothing all that unpleasant about nothing happening. In fact, it's probably a good thing if nothing's happening. You know, if I drive to work and nothing happens on the way there, traffic-wise, that's a good thing, right? And that's pleasant if I bother to reflect on it. Ajahn Tiridamo, the abbot at Wellington at the time, kind of a roly-poly, jolly kind of guy, he liked candy. One of the things that happens at the monastery is that you give the monks whatever they like. You try to please them. It's a sign of honor. It's kind of part of the tradition. Bring them wonderful food. The monasteries were supported down there by the Thai community and the Sri Lankan community, and people would get up at 3 a.m. These women would get up and cook this outlandish feast and deliver it to the monastery by 10:30 a.m. Maybe they started 2 days ago, who knows, but the food was great. So if you ever have a chance to go to a monastery and hang out, you'll eat well. Ajahn Tiridamo, so he would always start out by reflecting on the devotion of the people in the community and how much pleasure that gave him. He would just kind of chat about that a little bit at the beginning of a meditation, share that feeling of joy that he received from the devotion and the gifts that he got from the people that he was serving and teaching. Ajahn Vajiro, he's an abbot up in Canada, near Ottawa, Canada now. But he had taken some time out of his life as a abbot to take care of his mother while she was dying. But it ended up being, I don't remember, 7 or 9 years. He was with her quite a few years. He would spend a few days. He started developing the monastery at Ottawa because of this, taking care of his mom. So he needed a place to practice. And so he started kind of developing a new setting there. And so he would come and go back and forth between staying with his mom and going there. And he would return with flowers every time. And then he would always share this story of returning with the flowers and seeing his mom face light up at seeing him, being so happy that he was back, having that ability to bring her joy and to even add on to the joy by bringing her flowers was made it even bigger. So we have this capacity to get joy from giving to other people and seeing that we've helped somebody to be happier. So that's another source of that. I walked by the co-op. I went to the Seward Co-op a couple days ago, and they have seating, countertop, so you can eat there and look out the window. And so I'm walking on the sidewalk right by the window, and there's this little girl, and she's eating a noodle, and she's got a big gap in her teeth, and the noodle's kind of like she's playing with it and making the noodle go through the gap. And I caught her doing it, and she smiled, and I smiled. And so then I didn't stay in the co-op very long. I was leaving, and she was there when I was coming back the other direction, and she saw me, and I saw her, and it was a big smile and a wave. And you know, that was just this little moment of joy that I was awake enough to have that happen and appreciate it, you know. And now I can still, 3 days later, bring that to my memory, and I just see this beautiful little girl with a big happy face and the noodle going between her teeth. And it gladdens my heart. Trying to think of who else there was. Okay, so now I'm to Ajahn Suchito, who has written a lot of books, and I use his books a lot. I think you'll see this book out in the entranceway, this one about meditation. And it's a great book for learning how to meditate. Mine's signed. I have a signed copy. So, and again, as you work with this book, you'll see this idea that we want to develop a great heart. We want to have some ideas that we put in our mind, bring to mind acts of kindness that we've done towards other people, acts of kindness that other people have done towards us. Maybe we hate human beings today, including myself. So then in that event, I love my pet cat. And that can gladden the heart. I came home from work. I work at a treatment center. I come home at midnight. I'm tired of beat. It was like, excuse the French, it was a shit show. But I came home, and there was a cat across the street. Well, this cat used to be in my neighbor's house, and then the neighbors moved on and left the cat behind, and now she lives around the corner. But she comes to my back door and talks, meow, 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 and when my back door is open. So I like this little cat. Sometimes if I'm walking in the neighborhood, she's always out and around. She'll follow you. She'll walk with me for like 2 blocks at a time. It's a funny cat. And she was standing there waiting. I don't know if she was waiting for me, but she happened to be there. And so I crossed the street, and she talked for a long time and rolled around on her belly, and I rubbed it. And so, you know, it was another way that I just saw, like, okay, I'm getting a lot of joy out of this funny little cat. And it took away that whatever I had going on from work. And again, you know, that happened a week ago. I can still bring it to mind and get good feelings from it. So Ajahn Suchito, in this book, if you use this book, you're going to see that he encourages you over and over to bring to mind some incident, some, you know, I'm meeting somebody and they're glad to see me. I'm glad to see someone. All these, you know, whatever you can do to brighten the heart. And that coincides, I mean, that's absolutely what the Buddha's teaching. You know, we have these seeds of happiness and joy. They're inside of us. We forget about them when we're vexed or whatever we are. You know, I have a very aversive mind. If I get hold of somebody did something bad and it affected me poorly, I'm like, so it can be really hard to get myself to get off those tracks, and it doesn't, it's not useful to hang out there. It's not skillful. We all do it, and that's why the Buddha's teaching us to find ways to, other ways around this, you know. So I'm going to read a little bit from Ajahn Suchito about Great Heart. And this is a quote from the Buddha. So with a boundless heart, should one cherish all living beings? I think we chanted that today. Maybe. Do you ever feel that you're on your own? That you're the odd one out, the flawed or failed one? The one who's getting a bad deal, or that you really messed up in your life? Maybe as you're reading this, you're ill or experiencing bereavement. Maybe you're serving time in prison. Maybe you're just feeling depressed or isolated. When you're feeling small or under pressure, what's needed is great heart. Great heart is something that will develop for you through meditation. The simple practice of being mindful of sitting still or steady walking brings you to a firmer place in yourself, your still center. This is because mind is a mixture of heart and brain functions, in which the heart is predominantly involved with the steady receptivity we call mindfulness and clear comprehension. The heart is not just a metaphor for emotions and intuitions. The physical heart is an organ of perception that A, emits electromagnetic impulses that check out what's happening, and B, is in continual neurological dialogue with the brain. So when we tune into a still body or the rhythm of breathing, the message we receive is that things are fine and the brain quiets down. This is often overlooked as a function of the heart. It is a major contributor to direct experience versus figured out, learned, or abstract knowledge. So the world of science is finding a lot of ways to provide evidence by measuring how things change in the brain. I don't know all the things they measure, but there's electromagnetic brain imagery, and they're just finding a lot of evidence to prove out things that the Buddha taught 2,600 years ago. So I think that's pretty cool. I think in our Western world, we tend to just really separate the mind from the body. We think mind is the brain having thoughts. So when I first was introduced to Buddhism and the Dhammapada, the Dhammapada starts out by, this is a basic set of Buddha's teachings. It says, mind is the forerunner of all actions. All deeds are led by mind, created by mind. If one speaks or acts with a corrupt mind, suffering follows, just as the wheel follows the hoof of an ox pulling a cart. It's got the twin turnaround where happiness follows. But I viewed mind when I first read that, and I kept that view for a lot of years, that mind was my thinking mind, just having thoughts. And I didn't realize that it was this heart-body mind. And that's been a big shift for me to put that view into practice. I taught first grade for a while, first, second, third grade, and they were taking away gym from the kids because they didn't have money. And then they were taking away recess because the kids were fighting. And, you know, they have, it's like, really, do you think these are little heads coming to school without bodies? I mean, those bodies are full of energy. I was just like appalled. And then to see myself doing this kind of same, you know, parallel to myself, like I'm just this brain with thinking going on and not really realizing that I've got a body. and that the body is part of, you know, that my heart's in there, and that my heart is a knowing part of my body, probably knows more than my brain. So it's that kind of developing that direct knowing and taking care of it, just really learning how to take care of it. This calm offers the space within, which another major heart attribute can comfort. Heart knowing is to do with feeling. And it inclines to coherence and ease. So through meditation, the warm emotional intelligence that we all have can open up and come forth. Also, the skills that you develop in referring to that inner ground will greatly strengthen your sense of balance and confidence. And that means you don't tend to get caught in burdened or speedy states of mind. Meditation on the body, the direct experience of its feelings, energies, and rhythms, brings the receptive heart into play. From there, we can cultivate the heart as a center of attitude and inclination by picking up the heart's natural inclination towards empathy. Then, when we consciously attune our thinking to empathy with others, this heart knowing is given a major boost and role in our lives. Empathy brings us out of isolation within which we get tight, defensive, jealous, and it begins with a simple but often overlooked reflection that whatever state we're in, other people have been there, are there right now, will also come the same way and get through it. It may seem like small comfort, but when you develop this reflection, it transforms that sense of being stuck in your predicament into the sense that we're in this together. This sense provides a ground from which the mind can lift out of its downward spiral. Because to have others there in the same struggle is an experience of solidarity. That's one aspect of what Sangha, the community of disciples, means. Empathy gives you a place to stand. If we develop that sense of widening out of the narrow and trapped me sense, we can get through what life is bringing us at this time instead of plummeting down into despair or churning up with bitterness because others have come through challenges we can. This is the courage and confidence of the great heart, and it's in all of us. As long as we keep in touch with this capacity, the great heart stays with us. It can bear with what's passing through us and bring forth compassion for others. It mirrors and senses many changing states, but its reflective and empathic nature isn't in any particular state. Properly trained, it can sense a mental or physical state, reflect on it, and also widen out of the limitations of that state. We don't have to deny a feeling or get lost in the stories that our emotions evoke. So I had a coworker, a young lady new to the job, and she's not trained in that field of counseling and doesn't have a lot of skill in that area, and she's decided that I don't either. So we're not getting along too well at work. And what's been useful to me lately is just popped in my head when I was reading this. You know, it's like realizing that I don't end here. It's like when Thich Nhat Hanh teaches, he talks a lot about we inter are. We're not individuals. We are interbeing. We're interconnected. We inter are. And I just started thinking of her as being an extension of myself because I've been practicing really a lot, really hard to try to take care of my own anger when it arises and my own ridiculous misperceptions when I catch them. And, you know, that she's young, she's from a different culture, all these things. And I just started thinking of her as being an extension of me, and how can I take care of this anger? The anger isn't hers, it's not mine, it's just anger. And it's been helpful. Knowing that I've been through it, seeing her go through it, why wouldn't she be going through it? We all go through it. Thich Nhat Hanh has some really lovely ways of talking to the self when we feel negative. It's really simple. He talks about mantras. Again, Thich Nhat Hanh, very simple but not easy. You think he's talking, I don't know how many people have read him, but I always think he's just the simplest guy to read, and then I watch him on YouTube, and or, you know, maybe I'll be reading along, and all of a sudden he takes this deep sea dive, and he's like, whoa, where'd he go? But he's just saying, like, take an emotion, like anger, and say, anger, I know you are there. I will take care of you. He talks to you about taking care of your anger like it's a baby. Like you would take care of a crying baby. So kind of turning towards this anger, the anger that's hurting the heart, and just imagine cradling it and rocking it, and saying, dear one, I'm here for you. Dear one, I'm here for you. That's what we do for babies. We hold them till they calm down. He talks about anger. If you see if your house is on fire, you don't run around trying to see who set the fire. I'm going to go get so-and-so. They set the fire. You stay home. You take care of your house. You put the fire out. And so he compares anger to that. Fire. It's destroying your house. Take care of it. Stay home. Take care of it. Don't run around trying to figure out who started it. So I think I'll share a little bit of Thanissaro Bhikkhu too. Thanissaro Bhikkhu is he's an American monk. He's an abbot. Ajahn means teacher in this tradition. That means you've been a monk for at least 10 years. You cannot be a teacher unless you've been a monk for 10 years in the tradition. Thanissaro Bhikkhu, so he's at Center Valley, California, or Valley, I always say it wrong. I don't know why Hazelden gets in my mind when I say this guy's Valley Center. Ufta. So he's in Valley Center, California. He's the abbot of the monastery there. He's done a lot of academic work in the Thai Theravada tradition. Got a lot of books out. He's very well respected by the monks in the tradition. So this is from a talk of his from 2002. In the Mood is the name of the talk. And he refers right away to Ajahn Suwat. Ajahn Suwat, often recommended, putting yourself in a good mood each time before you meditate. This may sound a little backwards for many of us because we meditate in order to put ourselves in a good mood. And yet, he says to start out with a good mood. But when you stop to think about it, there's really no way you can get good results out of the meditation, unless the mind has at least some good qualities in it. Some cheerfulness, some patience, some wisdom. These are qualities that act as seeds that allow the meditation to develop. We're not totally empty-handed when we come to the meditation. We do have good qualities in the mind, and there are plenty of things we can think about to put the mind in a good mood. This is why we have to chant. This is why we have the chant on goodwill to start out the meditation each and every time. Goodwill is a good thing to think about. You look at yourself spreading thoughts of goodwill, and you feel good about yourself. You're not totally selfish, not totally angry, vindictive, whatever. There's at least some goodness inside you. You take that as your starting capital. As with any investment, you need to have something to begin with. If you don't have money, at least you've got strength, or you've got your intelligence. You take whatever good things you've got, and you invest them. That's how they grow. So, when we sit here to meditate, we do our best to make the mind patient, to lift it above its ordinary cares and concerns of the day, and then bring it to the meditation object. Usually, in our tradition, meditation object is the breath. That way you can relate to the breath or whatever your object in a friendly way. Being in a good mood puts the breath in good shape as well. If you feel frustrated about your breathing or frustrated about your meditation, that's going to do funny things to your breath. Make it harder and harder to stay with the breath. So think in whatever way helps the mind to get ready to meditate, in the mood to meditate. This is the part of the first basis of success. The desire to meditate. You want to meditate. You feel an inclination, an attraction to the meditation. If you sit down and you feel yourself totally disinclined to meditate, don't just force yourself to do it. Remind yourself of the good reasons for why you're doing it. So in other words, if I sit down and I strive to meditate and I say, I'm going to meditate right now, I got to meditate, I'm really not going to get much out of it. Think of ways to make it interesting or ways to make it entertaining. You can do all kinds of things with the breath. Look at Ajahn Lee's Dhamma talks. When he defines the different levels of breathing in the body, he hardly ever repeats himself. There's always something new, something different that he's found from his meditation. We don't have to memorize all his ways of analyzing the breath. We should give them a try, of course, but look at our own ways of analyzing the breath and energy and see what works for us. When you feel depressed, what kind of breathing feels uplifting and energizing? When you feel manic, what kind of breathing feels grounding? When you feel lazy, what kind of breathing energizes you? When you feel tense, what kind of breathing relaxes you? There's a lot to explore, and in the exploration, you get absorbed in the breath, without even thinking about forcing yourself or holding a whip over the mind. Don't let thoughts of frustration or discouragement take charge of the mind. The Dalai Lama once said that the thing he found most surprising about Westerners was their self-hatred. In Tibet, he said only the village idiot feels self-hatred. And it's also true, I noticed, in Thailand. Perhaps not so much anymore. As modern culture moves in, it really does teach people to hate themselves, to feel bad about themselves. It holds up all sorts of images of physical and financial perfection that nobody can live up to. But in traditional culture, one of the basic skills of being a human being was essentially how to feel good about yourself, how to love yourself, how to wish yourself well, and how to feel good about others, how to love others, how to wish them well. Only really stupid people would hate themselves, and yet that kind of stupidity is rampant now in the modern world. Be careful not to pick it up. If you're thinking in ways that are self-destructive, in ways that are really harmful to yourself, and you simply stop, it's like running a truck into a wall. You can get thrown through the windshield or suffer whiplash. But if you learn how to think in ways that are for your own true benefit, like the things we chant about every evening, which are always beneficial to think about, then when the time comes for the mind to settle down and think less and less and less and get more and more absorbed in the present moment, it's a lot easier. So I know I've encountered a lot of people are trained in mindfulness in a psychological manner. And I'm taking that from Ajahn Viradamo. He used that term for how psychology takes mindfulness a lot of times, psychological. And it kind of loses the heart. And so you hear things like mindfulness is watching your thoughts go by like bubbles. And if you have a broken heart or something, that might not be all that useful. I mean, I think it's just really important to gladden the heart, get that peace in there. It's made a big difference for me. And the body, that the body is a source of pleasure. So I like to practice yoga too. That helps me because I still struggle with those mental formations quite a bit, the negative ones. Got a lot of years in, a lot of ruts in the brain. So knowing that I can come at it from the other direction, that brightening the body can also brighten the mind, is useful, because sometimes the mind's being very, very, very unruly. And if I just take myself to a yoga class and participate and get my body feeling better, my mind will benefit. It's kind of a biofeedback system. And I like to remember that the Buddha, those basic teachings that I shared in the beginning for our meditation, that he starts right out. You know, we're breathing, we're in our bodies the minute we do that. The body anchors us to this present moment, this here and now. I can be free of all that discursive thinking through the body.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.